to Two Peas in a Podcast on a very mild summer's day, Trevor, considering what we've been dealing with. So I'm Michelle, hello.
And I'm Trevor, hello. And it is only 27 today, so it is nice to be out there for the first time in weeks. We've had extreme weather again, and the whole world knows that the east coast of Australia has burnt like a bonfire.
I've been getting text messages and messages from the family in Holland because, of course, they have no concept of the spaciousness. So particularly when they hear that half of Kangaroo Island has been scorched or burnt, geographically, like spatial-wise, that's the same size as Holland. So they're concerned and thinking we're hanging on to the edge of the coast for dear life. But it's certainly been a summer that, you know, Trevor, it's been a summer where we have to recognise that changes need to happen in the garden.
Yes, it has. And we are talking about gardening in a dry land today. We have talked about it before, and in fact it's a very popular subject because there are a lot of deserts like our deserts throughout the world, and in the Middle East in particular, the Islamic religion has a belief that the inner garden, the garden that's in the courtyard, is paradise, and they look at it and they see it as a thing of beauty as well as of relaxation, and I think also a bit of mental health, in that it unstresses them because they can get there and they can just see nature, and that is something that we probably haven't talked much about, in the garden being a anti-stress thing. But in the case of surrounded by desert, water is a very relaxing thing, and water in the garden of course has a beautiful sound, has a beautiful look, and it has just that cooling effect. So although we're talking about gardening in a dry land, one of the paradoxes is you look at ways to maximize your water, and that's also the point with bushfires. It's so dry then has so much heat load that the fire got way and truly out of control, you know. But at any rate, a lot of people have written on this subject of dry land gardening. I think myself of our native plants. You can't avoid the fact that they remain unaffected and still growing in this climate at this time after an extremely hot summer. And like you say, we've got to think of change, and maybe natives is the way to go.
I think so. I think for me personally, I've liked natives, but I think I've always been a little bit nervous about them, a little bit cautious. And as you and I were chatting before, you tend to grow what you know. You tend to grow what your parents grew, what your grandparents grew. However, unfortunately, my daughter-in-law has an Indigenous background, and her family are heavily involved in growing and cultivating and using bush tucker. And that has really opened my eyes to the usage. I think it's a little bit, you feel a little bit nervous. So I had a bit of a think about it, and I thought, what is it that is stopping us from growing more natives? And I think there are perhaps a few myths around them where people assume that they're not beautiful. Well, that is absolutely wrong. I mean, you and I, Trevor, have both been up to the Port Augusta arid lands, and that is one of the most beautiful botanical gardens you could come across.
Yep.
It's a little bit looking with different eyes. I think we become a little bit attached to the idea of our flowers, you know, how they're meant to look. But certainly I've started planting a lot more natives. I was quite lucky. I had some Banksia when I moved into my house. But what I'm building at the moment in the back of my house is what they call a native corridor, I suppose, for want of another word. And I put in some Banksias and some Grevilleas just because I wanted to attract the flowers. Well, they tripled in size in 2 years. I'm astounded. And unbelievable. But I've also put in some saltbush, some ruby saltbush.
Yep, I got some of that.
And a friend of mine, she uses the ruby saltbush in her cooking, and you chuck a handful of that and then you can take the seeds. What I did find just through doing a little bit of research myself on some more native plants, it's very important that you do plant for the area. That's vitally important. But there's a lot of research, like there's a lot of help out there, like the Natural Resource Management Group, even ringing your local council. They are more than happy to help you work out what native plants are, because Trevor's absolutely right. The glory, and the other thing too that is that even if our native plants get a bit of a beating, like my grevilleas had a bit of a beating on some of those hot days, a couple of really nice days and a splash of water and they are back again, which is fabulous. So we will be talking a little bit more about bush tucker in the next few podcasts, but for the minute, certainly arid planting, give it some thought.
Yeah, there are some downsides. I mean, I've got self-sown trees that have grown above my head in 2 years. Mm. That's native trees, so they're terrific. But the shade of the gum tree is partial.
Yes, that's correct.
You see, and right. We are still Europeans, and there is a writer in South Australia called Trevor Nottle. He works on, the Waite Institute. He's written a book in which the main gist of the book is that if you're in a hot climate, you need cool green shade, and it is available to us. We do have the desert ash, for instance, which is a deciduous tree, but when it comes out in the summertime, it is total shade. And we have the carob, which is a native tree with a very long single tap root. It's a street tree, so it doesn't interfere with your underlying services and whatnot, but it provides a beautiful total green shade. And that's what he was meaning, I think. One of your defences against the really hot weather, and country or city, is to create a sort of tree grove in which you're surrounded by 4, 6, 8 trees, and they're providing you with total shade. And you put your table and chairs out there, and you catch the cooling breeze in the evening, and you sit there and you watch the birds, and you just contemplate. I'm good at this. Doing nothing is my specialty.
As we are recording this podcast, isn't Nita contemplating with a beer out the carob grove as we speak?
She is, yes.
You're right, which is absolutely fantastic. And then the ground is cooler, and it's also about getting out there a little bit. I think that's the part that I find a little bit sad when I see so many air conditioners and so much concrete that even when the temperature goes down, nobody's inclined to go and sit outside. I mean, I'm inclined to sit outside. As you know, my whole back veranda is covered in grapevines.
Yep.
And so those pavers never get hot in the summer. So all I need is a temperature to drop a tiny little bit, and I'm like you. Obviously, my yard's a lot smaller, but I'm out in the backyard amongst the fruit trees and just sitting there enjoying the cool.
Well, trees are natural ones in that they bring the water up from deep down below, and as they bring it up, they transpire it, so they're humidifying the air. And don't forget, our hot days have got about 5% relative humidity, so they're very, very dry, and that humidity will effectively cool the place. The other thing is there is a regenerative process in which they drop leaves on the ground, and that helps the ground. Not only is it now shaded, but it's also getting annual composting put on top of it. And if you then plant understories, you know, the old shrubs and the ground covers, well, then you start to build up the whole thing, and the whole thing starts to transpire and stay cool and remote. And the colour green is just a cooling colour too.
And immediately, and the thing is, if in our arid land, we are able to do this in our own backyards, in bigger properties, like you said, doing that planting and looking at, well, what can we plant to create those microclimates that even, you know, in the evening provides us with that reprieve.
Yeah, it does.
Getting outside.
I feel it. As the sun goes down, and we got good birds flying overhead there, but I think you get them in the suburbs too, and you begin to appreciate the life that comes with the trees and all that.
Absolutely.
The other writer in South Australia who's very famous is Sophie Thompson of Gardening Australia fame. She has a theme quite different, really, but it shows you just how wide this topic you chose of planting in dry land is, and that she said, well, the best thing is to plant in autumn, not spring. So that's total change from Europe. Europe and North America is frozen in winter. You would not contemplate winter planting. But here, it's quite mild. And so you can, as far as possible, swap over your main vegetable crops to the winter. Now, it does depend a lot on whether you get frost or not. So if you're in the Adelaide Hills, you're still limited, you know. Yeah. You're still limited to the broccolis, brassicas, cabbages, Brussels sprouts and parsnips and things that can enjoy the frost. And there are a lot of things that rely upon the frost. But here we don't even have frost much. And so the range of plants that you can grow in the winter is quite extensive here, in that you can grow onions, leeks, garlic, which are the family, and the cauliflower, cabbage, broccoli, wombok, radish, mustard, those are all the brassica family. Carrots, beetroot, parsnips, celery, peas, broad beans, lettuce, silver beet and spinach. So that's quite a garden in winter.
It is. It's a fantastic garden in winter. And you're right about that whole, we have to start thinking differently. The problem is, I think, why we still think we've got to plant heaps in spring is there's still something about spring that makes you want to rush out there. I think we're genetically predisposed to planting heaps in spring, and you're absolutely right. Plant in autumn because it is milder, it is winter, and also you may possibly, although we didn't this winter, did we, Trevor, you may get some rain.
No. Well, that's the idea. The idea is it's cooler, you get rain, and everything you can grow in winter, you don't have to grow in summer, therefore you're saving summer water.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, I didn't. My corn is doing very well, and my tomatoes, but I actually didn't end up putting a lot of things in this summer because I was really mindful of the fact that it was so hot.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it is becoming a bit of a problem. You still are forced to, you know, grow your tomatoes and your corn and your basil and your zucchini, all the ones that are actually not going to get enough sun have to be grown. You can advance them into early spring.
But my corn's just gone. Thank you very much for this spate of 40-degree weather. I think it is basically the only thing that's happy with this weather.
Well, I did very well this year with tomatoes, and it was cheating because it was growing inside on my windowsill, which was getting the northern sun. I planted my tomatoes in pots in June, and then I transferred them into bigger pots in July, and even bigger in August, and then I planted them out in September, and I've had a terrific crop.
You have had a terrific.
That's the other way. Protected growing started out as hothouses, but now you read everywhere that everyone's worried about growing just in the open because it's not just the heat. It's, you know, it's insects and no one wants to use insecticide, and it's rabbits and no one wants to kill nice little furry things, you know. And it's birds and everyone loves birds. So thinking of your whole garden now, a veggie garden probably, if you said 100 square metres, 10 metres by 10 metres, you'd be talking about quite a big veggie garden.
It's a huge garden, yeah.
Yeah, but that is quite possible under white shade cloth and just a certain amount of steel you have to buy from the local steel merchant. But you get it up there, it's not very heavy. It needs to be firm in that it doesn't want to flap. But you can build this enclosure out of white shade cloth that is on the market now. It allows the bees in, it allows the insects in, it allows the water in, and you can have it retractable. You can have it actually on track so you can move it aside when you don't want it.
Okay.
So these things are coming. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here, including the native flora, I mean, I'm sure we're going to get a lot more native plants on our menus in the future, and I'm also sure that the garden is going to find itself more and more under shade cloth and various forms of removable coverings, because wherever you are in the world, whether you're protecting yourself against frost or snow, whether you're protecting yourself against animals, or whether you're just doing it because you're in too hot a climate, well, then there's going to be a lot of it.
Absolutely. Like we said earlier, that's around that different way of thinking. We have got to think differently. Which brings us to, though, you've been really impressed with some of the cellars and bushfire bunkers that you've been forced to look at while wine tasting. I mean, honestly, the lengths Trevor will go to research is very impressive.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm proud of it.
I know.
But this protected growing is a way of sort of growing inside, and it's not just growing, it's storing and processing, because they're an integral part of both growing and cooking. So potatoes, pumpkins, onions can all be stored for a year, really, if you get them underground in the cool temperature. You can make your own cheeses, your own beer, a bit harder making your own wine, but they all mature better if you have a constant temperature. And I've got a little cellar at 22 degrees year round, so it's warmer in winter and it's cooler in summer and it's livable all year round. So if you have got the money, a cellar is not as stupid as it once was, you know.
No, I think, and people are talking more. I read a article today in Earth Garden magazine. Jackie French, fabulous, amazing writer. I can't rave on about her enough. And she's certainly done a lot to raise awareness around this sort of thing. And she was talking about with bushfires that they have built a bunker. They've actually, for their own safety, it's a different way we have to think.
Well, I put in a big tank. The fire brigade think I should wait until the fire comes before I use it, but I don't. And it's the same thing with a bunker. It's just another name for a cellar, and it keeps a constant temperature. So whilst you're not sheltering there, you're storing your goods in there.
Absolutely.
The other thing is that microgreens are what we used to call sprouts. And they are also a form of gardening, but you can do them just by having trays and collecting the water at the bottom and just putting in seed like alfalfa seed and chickpea seed and various mung bean seeds and stuff, and they're all sprout, and they've got the same amount of nutrient in them after 7 days as the actual plant has after 7 weeks. So they're highly nutritious. They grow very quickly in a protected environment, and it might require artificial light. I'm not sure because I don't think they do because I've grown them in the pantry before. But these things too are worthwhile considering. If the food's going to get dearer, well then sheltering is a good way of ensuring success because you have a microclimate which is out of the wind, which means lower evaporation and water use. And you have a chance of recycling your water too. That's with the trays and the contained area in which you're growing. So these things are good ideas for people who are...
They're another one that's become quite trendy, hasn't it? Whereas I find that I have the little seed trays and we grow them in the classroom when I'm teaching. Fantastic. Like you said, quick, easy. The kids can do it. You know, it's a little bit of a... quick and easy, something that they get a immediate response from. Make a sandwich, chuck it on there, make a salad, lob it off, chuck it on there. It's absolutely fantastic, and then it grows again and again. And they're really undervalued. I think sprouts are really undervalued. Handful in a smoothie. So I agree with you. I think that's a fantastic idea. And yeah, like you said, you just keep pouring the water back on and on and on again. And once again, a little bit of extra greenery in the house. Not much, but it's like a little bit of extra, which I think certainly helps in this weather.
Yeah, well, the next topic I thought of was this dawn and dusk. There is a name for animals that feed at dawn and dusk, but I think it could be transferred to gardeners. They should really be watering in the morning and transplanting things in the evening. So they should really be asleep during the day.
Yeah,
and
agree.
In this hot weather, they should get out in the morning and then sleep until the evening and then do some more work.
I will take that as an order, Trevor. That would be my new way of living. No, I agree with you. My nieces and I were out in the garden before Christmas. Honestly, it must have been 5:30, 6 o'clock. It was just that really early dusk. I'm lucky one of my nieces is extremely keen to go and squeeze an egg out of a chook, so she would get up nice and early. And we just started pottering around in the garden, and it's actually a delightful time to garden. It's a really lovely time to garden. I must confess, I don't water in the morning, generally. But that's more of a time constraint because I've got to go to work. And then I tend to water in the evening, and I know that that's not ideal.
Well, but this climate.
It means I can enjoy the garden.
Yeah.
If I water in the morning, it's a real like, quick, I've got to water, and then I've got to do this, and then I've got to do that. Yeah. Whereas if I water in the evening, I can have a glass of wine. Yeah. I can enjoy the garden. If I have a glass of wine at 6 o'clock in the morning, the neighbours frown upon me terribly. I would prefer to water in the morning, and I know a lot of my neighbours do.
I don't think it matters because I think, once again, that's European, North American thinking. Yeah. I think the thing dry up fine because it's so dry, you know.
Yeah, you're right. You are right.
So I don't think any rot.
So I can keep having my glass of wine in the evening and water.
Oh, I must
the
do, yeah. And sit
pretending.
Down. And, well, I found I had timers that would turn the taps on automatically, and I came rushing out and I kept missing the watering time. It's like missing feeding time at a zoo, you know. Whoa. watering time in the garden's the best time to be there.
It is. I have ducks in my garden. Obviously, they're not native or anything like that. But you'll be standing there with the hose, and these ducks who generally are not super friendly are quite happy to sort of schmooze up to you because as you're watering, you kind of bring it up all these bugs and they're like, oh, let's see what we're doing.
We've got magpies and other birds that are like that. Yeah, for sure. The birds come around for a shower. We also keep a lot of water bowls going for the birds, but they have baths. You know, the water disappears because of bathing more than drinking.
Which is delightful. Once again, what a delightful way to spend after a stinking hot day inside to just sit and just enjoy that. You know, it's lovely.
Mm. Yeah, well, today, after watching YouTube, today I did a bit of overdue pruning. And this is sort of midsummer pruning. And you're deadheading the lavender and the rosemary and, you know, the salvias and stuff and the herbs as well because they've grown and you haven't had a chance because I'm actually a very intelligent person. I walk out at lunchtime saying, right, I'll do the gardening and then I hit with this heap, I walk straight back in just to demonstrate my intelligence, you know. So you are behind at this stage because it has been too hot for too long.
It has.
And so a lazy way of pruning is called lop and drop.
Trevor has explained this to me prior to the podcast and I have become a huge fan already because I think this is a great idea.
Well, I mean, all it is, it's a bit like no dig in that it relies upon the fact that everything that falls on the garden soil will eventually become compost. And if it's falling on there, it's acting like mulch. So you don't have to buy mulch and you don't have to buy compost. You just chop up all the prunings a bit shorter than you normally would. So they all form a mat on top of the ground and they hide the sprinkler pipes and they hide the ground. They take away the heat and they look a bit untidy, but that's me. You know, I'm not worried about that.
No, I'm the same.
So it looks a bit like you dumped a whole lot of branches and leaves and stuff and they die off and they look like they dumped a whole lot of dead leaves and branches and stuff. But it doesn't matter. You get a lot of work done. It's no point in composting, actually, because you've got to have non-chlorinated water for your compost, and during summer we don't have it. The only water we got is mains water, which is chlorinated, and it's not much good on compost because it will kill the bacteria. So if you drop it down where you've got gardens and where things have been growing, well, your sprinklers or your watering routine will actually wet it, and that will, I think, decompose quicker than the compost. And once again, composting is in winter and spring when the, you know, grass is everywhere and the rain is everywhere and you don't need to wet your compost. But in summertime now, I think you just leave it where it is. Don't bother.
Yeah, I agree. And look, and anything that offers some sort of protection to those roots and those systems is, like, brilliant.
Often drop. The other thing I just got to put a word in about is tomato laterals. I get lots of friends coming around my tomatoes and while they're talking to me, they're picking off the laterals, which is a shoot between the leaf and the stem. That's all right. That's a good idea in one sense in that you'd rather have 100 good tomatoes than 300 little ones. So it does prune it in that sense. But you need a lot of leaf cover in this climate because the fruit will get sunburnt if it's out in the full blast of the midday sun. So I think maybe take off the laterals until you get to the first fruiting stem and then leave them on and just take them off as you require.
Last year I cut back my tomatoes too much. They either burnt or they just didn't stand a chance. And this year I have kind of left them because I've thought to myself, you know, it's me, any extra stuff I've got. I haven't, my Tommy Toes or the little tiny tomatoes haven't started up yet. My stuff's been a little bit late, but I have noticed that the tomatoes haven't had that burn that they had last year, and this summer's certainly been a lot hotter.
Well, so, we had that 48 degree day.
Oh, that's true. That's right. We're the garden just set. Yeah, that's true. Please don't let's have another one of those.
Bring on the monsoons.
Yeah, gosh, that's all right. So now, cacti and succulents.
Yes.
Trevor.
Yes.
You've said that you're not a big fan or you don't know much or...
Well, I mean, No, I'm not a fan. They're a bit prickly for me. But, yeah, I know they are good in desert climate.
Yeah, we had a teacher when I was in high school many thousands of years ago who was a big fan of the cactus, and he did try and convert, you know, converting teenagers to a cacti is, I mean, Lord love him. It probably highlighted his absolute love of them, that he thought we were going to become enamoured with them as well. We were not. I have only recently become a huge fan of the succulents and the cacti because my Olpa had a huge cacti which flowered once a year, and it was such an event that, you know, we'd get the phone call that this beautiful, beautiful flower, and my Olpa used to say to me, which was really rather delightful because I just, the cacti itself, I don't know the name of it, had these huge spikes and we were always terrified of it.
Mm.
And he used to say, see, you know, everything has its time, everything has this beautiful moment.
Mm.
But I'm a big fan of succulents for pots, so I basically stick anything in an old broken teapot or, you know, I love all that kind of gardening. And the thing that works the best is the succulents. Mm. And I've got a gorgeous two little hanging pots that, you know, the neighbour, people are always giving me stuff because I'm always sticking plants in it. And then I've noticed recently that all the succulents have multiplied, which was really exciting because nothing much is growing at the moment. So I think the succulents are a gorgeous idea, and they're certainly nice for borders and things like that. And looking at, once again, it's a little bit of that different headset. Yeah. So they might not do the flowering as much, but looking at the different shape and colour and the variegated leaves and all that sort of stuff, that they add something to the garden, and they don't need heaps of water, which is delightful.
Yeah, I think they're coming. I think much of this is coming, and it's forced upon us, but, you know, you can like what's forced upon you and then make a good thing out of it.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Also forced upon us is reuse of our stormwater and reuse of our water generally. Now, stormwater is just rainwater. If it goes straight into the tank from the gutter, that's the end of it until the tank gets full. But a lot doesn't go into the tank. A lot just runs across the paths, and that runoff water, that surface runoff, is what is mainly referred to as stormwater, but the overflow from the tank in as well is as well. And there's, well, it's probably been two decades now that the Salisbury Council have had this brilliant wetlands, and the people who've done that have done an absolutely brilliant job on a suburb scale, on a suburban scale, on a city scale, and that's happening a lot. And so we know a lot about this, but it's a lot of learning, and it's quite professional as well, because the Botanic Gardens have got a big filter underground and they're reusing all of their stormwater, which they should.
Yeah.
So this is for your house too. Yes, put in tanks, but if you're planning a new house, not just plan a cellar and a protected garden, but also plan the slope. Get the lowest part of the garden. That's where the water will end up. That should really be a stormwater catchment pond. Now, that can just be a foot deep or so, but you need to retain water to stop flooding of the city, but also retain it on your land as long as possible. And probably the best way to do it is soakage. So the overflow from the rainwater tank, for instance, can go into agricultural pipe, which is this pipe with slots in it, and it leaks the water out slowly, and that can be put under garden beds, run it into gravel beds, as in the wicking bed idea, where you build raised gardens and you have an area at the bottom of each bed where it's gravel that you just put your water directly into and force the roots into there. So there is a lot of ideas, including using, instead of concrete for your path, using various soft substitutes, you know, like wood chips and sawdust and pine bark or pine needles or pistachio shells or whatever. So you don't need
to eat a lot of pistachios. Well,
you can't get these things. Whatever's available, a soft path will mean that soakage into the path is maintaining water on your land, which is what you're trying to do. And all of this will benefit frogs and birds.
Yes, yeah, that's a bring your wildlife in. That's really the trick.
And they will
it?
Come. You don't have to do much. You offer them water and they'll come.
Yeah.
And also, it's a sort of moral thing in that you are filtering that water before it leaves your place. So you're running all the water, not just straight on concrete out into the curb, out into the ocean. That's probably yesterday's thinking, yeah, I'd absolutely. Say that city-wise, suburb-wise and home-wise, that's probably got to be rethought. And so you should try and get it soaking into your land, staying in your land as long as possible, reusing it wherever possible, but also using it for that deep watering of your ground.
I agree. So I think we've given everyone some food for thought, if nothing else.
Yes.
And I agree with you about the paths and things like that with the sawdust and remembering as well, even just that sense of cooling, isn't it? You know, the concrete is still so hot, isn't it? You know, think of some different things for that cooling and that's what our plants need, because if we're hot, they're hot, you know, and we need to remember that. So next month, we're going to talk about autumn planting. And hopefully when we speak to you then, it will be slightly cooler. We won't have had a 48-degree day.
Well, actually, to be honest with you, it's 27 today, so let's not get too sorry for ourselves.
No, it's been a beautiful week. Beautiful week coming up.
Yeah.
This time last year, it was hot. And once again, even in those really hot days, I mean, I'm quite fortunate. I've planted, as you know, with like a lot of greenery out the back and things like that, you know. Sit quiet, enjoy your garden when it's really hot. Like
I've planted some lettuce and, you know, rocket and wombok and various other things now, and they're coming through, so under shade, I must admit.
Under shade, yeah.
But so you can start now, because really it needs to be all planted by March, really, because then the cold weather comes, theoretically.
Theoretically. All right, so we will see you next month. So thank you from Michelle.
And Trevor.
And see you later. Two peas in a podcast.